You're going to love my next guest. His name is James Galliano. He's a West Point graduate, and he currently serves as a law enforcement analyst and policing methodology subject matter expert for CNN. There, he provides on-air analysis of complex law enforcement and counterterror matters. Now, prior to joining CNN, James had a long and decorated career with the FBI. Now, during his career, James held a variety of roles within the Bureau, to include assignment to the FBI's elite counterterror unit, the Hostage Rescue Team, or HRT, and as a senior team leader of the FBI New York Field Division SWAT team. Now, on this show, James and I talk about a variety of topics, from the hot topic issues of today to leadership to the way forward in law enforcement. You do not want to miss this show. James Galliano, next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here, host and creator of the top-ranked Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We know you have many options, but you keep coming back. That's why we continue to grow. Remember to share it with your family and friends and give us that 5-star rating on iTunes. I want to take a moment to give a big shout out to the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field, whether you're on the federal, state, or local level. Thank you all for doing a tremendous job, especially in these uncertain times. But every day you put on that uniform, you go out there, you give it your all, and you protect and serve because that is what you do. Remember, don't believe all the crap you hear in certain media outlets and what other people are saying. You are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved by millions. Keep up the great work. Folks, if you love coffee, and I know the majority of you do, you're in criminal justice, you're going to love the products from Four Sigmatic. I am a huge fan, have so for many years now, and I love the Lion's Mane mushroom coffee, and I'm willing to bet you will too. And yeah, you heard me right. I said mushrooms, but they're not the weird mushrooms. They're good mushrooms, good for you. I love the Lion's Mane mushroom coffee. It gives me that zip and energy and clarity that I need throughout the day. And again, you will too. If you head over to CJEvolution.com, you're going to see a link to Four Sigmatic. You're going to get 15% off using the promo code CJEVO. Enjoy. You know, here at the show, we are honored to be partnered with a great company like Detectichem. If you've never heard of this company, you need to become familiar with them because they are keeping the brave men and women who keep us safe every day safer by offering mobile threat detection that fits in the palm of their hands, detecting illicit drugs, explosives. They even have the ability to test for COVID-19 now. Yes, I said COVID-19. Again, if you head over to CJEvolution.com, you're going to see a link to Detectichem. See how they can help keep your troops safer. On to the show with the one and only James Galliano. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I am very, very excited for my next guest. James Galliano is a law enforcement analyst for CNN. He's also an adjunct assistant professor and doctoral candidate at St. John's University in Queens, New York. He went to West Point and he served as a light infantry officer with the 10th Mountain Division during the Cold War. And then he went into the FBI doing amazing things. One of those is he was part of the FBI's elite counterterrorism unit, HRT, which is the Hostage Rescue Team. James, are you there, sir?
I am, and it is a pleasure to join you. I'm looking forward to the conversation, brother.
Anything I missed? Did you do anything else in your career?
No, hopefully your listeners were all able to keep their lunches down listening to that wind-up. Probably-
And we were talking a little bit beforehand. We started, you were part of the 10th Mountain. Again, thank you for your service, sir, to this great country and your law enforcement service. That's just amazing. Not the 82nd, like we were talking about, but close enough. So I always ask people to come on, James, you know, Leos, former Leos, you know, what made you get into law enforcement? What was the catalyst, influence or something like that?
Yeah, I dial this thing down to one thing. I picked up a book called Donnie Brasco back in the late 80s.
Great movie.
And I was hooked. I mean, obviously, for your listeners, Donnie Brasco was the undercover name of a FBI agent by the name of Joe Pistone, who did some amazing work in the late 70s, you know, back when the FBI was just starting to get into undercover work, and he worked against the Colombo and the Bonanno crime families, which were one of the, you know, two of the top five crime families, the major crime families in New York City during the era of, you know, organized crime in New York City, did some amazing work. And there was a television show called Wise Guy, and a guy named Ken Wall played a fictional FBI agent called, with a name, Vinny Terranova. And I remember watching that when you only had three channels, right?
Yeah.
And it came on, and watching those two shows, I was just like, I want to do that. I want to be that guy. And that really, I wish it was something at a much higher or esoteric level, but it was like, I watched those two shows. I was a hero. I was a fan of, you know, Joe Pistone's book. And obviously you mentioned the movie afterwards with Johnny Depp and Al Pacino. And I watched Wise Guy, and that sold me.
Yeah. And why, you mentioned just Al Pacino. I remember watching Serpico. You remember Serpico?
And, sure.
Great, great movie. Great story. Now, what about the military? So what made you go into the military? Was there, I know you went to West Point, but did you have military in your family, sir, or what?
Yeah, so that's a little different. I didn't watch that on TV or read a book. So my family, on my father's side, my Sicilian side, came here in 1905, and they have served in every war or conflict that the U.S. has been involved in, with the exception of World War One. I guess in 1919 and 1918, they were just too busy, I guess. I'm kidding. it was generational. But so my father is West Point class of 60. My nephew is West Point class of 13, and I'm nestled in between West Point class 87. On my mother's side, the Petries, P-E-T-R-Y, they go all the way back. We've traced it all the way back to the Civil War. My great times three grandfather, Francis Petrie, my grandfather's namesake, was actually an artilleryman, a staff sergeant in the New York State Militia, the Orange Blossoms, and fought at Gettysburg. I have his separation papers from the New York State Militia dated 1871 and his sidearm that he carried at Gettysburg. So that side of my family too fought in World War II and Korea, and so yeah, it's the military was always a fait accompli for me. It was like I always knew that's what I was going to at least start doing, and that's how it worked out.
Isn't it amazing with the stuff we have and the information available to now to do the lineage and stuff like that? I mean, it's just truly amazing, and it's so honorable to have, you know, that background in your, you know, that family background. I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, we've come a long way in tracking things down from a genealogical perspective. Hell, a couple years ago for Christmas, my wife gave me a DNA test for my beloved rescued pit bull. So I know exactly who his mother was catting around town with, because he's 90% pit bull, 5% Labrador, and 5% Australian cattle dog. So that's how good the technology has gotten, brother.
Now, you've served honorably for many years in the FBI. You retired in 2016. We talked a little bit before we started about, you know, law enforcement and operations have changed dramatically. I was in law enforcement 23 years, but in the last just couple of years, James, I mean, do you think we're heading in the right direction? Maybe that's a stupid question, but I'll ask you anyway.
Well, the short answer to that is no, I don't think we're heading in the right direction. But the follow-on to that is this is predictable, because whether it's politics or sociological aspects of life, everything results in a major over course correction. So if you go one way in politics for 8 years, we always vote exactly the opposite way the next year. It's the way it's been in this country for 244 years. And it's the same thing with law enforcement. Look, I entered the FBI in early 91. And when I arrived in New York City as a Decatur, Georgia boy, I know I don't have an accent anymore, but when I arrived in Brooklyn, New York, just to begin my career, New York City had just ended the bloodiest year in its history. There were 2,245 homicides, and the vast majority of the victims and perpetrators, 90 to 95% were black or brown. They were people of color. This was during the height of the crack wars, right? Mm-hmm. Here we are now, okay? So that was 1990. So here we are 30 years later, and the policing methodologies, broken windows, CompStat, stop, question, and frisk, those things that took us from 2,245 homicides in 1990 to 300 and change last year. Now, that's 300 and change, too many mothers that are grieving the loss of a son due to senseless violence. Mm-hmm. But that is a 90%, 90 plus percent reduction in homicides. Okay, fast forward to where we are now. Everything that was done during those times, everything that was done, proactive policing, which I know you're familiar with, you know, using reasonable suspicion, you know, the Terry versus Ohio, the Terry stops, to stop, question, and frisk people that an officer has a reasonable suspicion to believe were carrying a sidearm, that made New York City, and obviously cities across the country, major cities, immeasurably safer. But what are we doing now? We see a couple incidents of some questionable misconduct by police. And look, there's 700,000, 800,000 uniformed police officers in the country. The vast majority of them are honorable, brave, decent public servants. There is an infinitesimal percentage. Mm-hmm. It is infinitesimal that are bad actors. But we take those, that infinitesimal percentage, and we blow it up. What we do is we isolate the few to smear the whole. And as a result of that, we now have these protests, these peaceful protests that have metastasized into riots, anarchy, looting, violence, arson, everything. We're now going to burn the system down literally and figuratively. And I gotta tell you, it is folly. Now, we will course correct on this, but I don't think it's gonna happen in one election cycle. I think we're 2, 3, 4, 10 years down the road, my friend, before we look at the carnage that's going to be laid in the wake of these changes and we go back to doing things the way we did back in the 90s and early 2000s.
You know, it's amazing. We were talking about this, James. You know, just last year, New York City was one of the safest cities in America. And now, under the leadership, New York City, I think the mayor got rid of 600 undercovers for the street crime unit, reassigned them. It just amazes me that we have that type of leadership out there, James, where they think that's going to solve everything. Most people in this country, I don't have the stats, but I would be willing to bet that most people want law and order in this country. And I don't live in New York City. You're close by. I mean, is there a mass exodus out of New York City? I mean, who's going to do business there anymore? I mean, who wants to live in the city? First of all, it's expensive as hell. If you're a business, why would you be there?
So if you look at, you know, if you look at the statistics for violent crime and crime in general, and you look at the top 10 cities that have the most violent crime per capita, 9 of them are run by Democrats. And yeah. I know you didn't have me on to come talk politics here, but yeah. I want to talk about it from the perspective of the folks that are aligned with the notion that we have to get rid of these policing methodologies because they are quote unquote racist. They've lost their mind. Mm-hmm. And they're in charge of cities like Philadelphia, Atlanta, New York, Baltimore, Seattle, Portland. I'm naming those cities and you're sitting there and you're probably cringing thinking, yeah. Wow, that's where all the violence right now is. Now, it's the same thing with insolvency. Those cities have tough times, you know, balancing their budgets. They're high tax areas. You pointed out New York City. New York City is 8.4 million people, right? It is the business mecca of the world. Who would want to have their business there now, knowing that you can have your business windows smashed in, your property looted and stolen and pilloried? You can you can have lawlessness in the street. People can smoke marijuana in the street corner, urinate on a corner of your building, and the police can't do a thing.
Ridiculous.
What happens? Ridiculous. People flee to the suburbs. People with the means flee to the suburbs. Businesses flee to the suburbs. And unfortunately, the folks that desperately need the police the most, those less affluent, those
exactly.
in those underserved communities, they're now left there with a higher tax bill, no tax base to help defray those costs, and stuck with the criminality that's going to be a result of this.
Now, what do you think there's going to be political consequences, James? Because somebody like de Blasio has been in office for a while now. Do you think there's going to be political consequences for some of these mayors and some of these leaders in these states and municipalities? Because, I don't know. Maybe they'll stay in power, but I think the majority of people out there, even in New York City, I saw an article the other day where a lot of New Yorkers are like, this is BS.
Yeah.
We want the cops, you know, we want the feds here.
I think you're right. But the way the politicians like de Blasio, you pointed out de Blasio, and there are many others, you know, Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, and you know, out in Seattle and Portland, they've got two mayors out there that are doing the same thing. They'll do it via death by a thousand cuts. And here's that what I mean. The NYPD, right? So the NYPD, you know, has a force of 36,000 cops. To put this into perspective, the FBI across the globe has 12,000 FBI agents. So for every FBI agent, there are three New York City cops. They have a budget of $6 billion. The city council in New York, in the most short-sighted, silly, pandering, ridiculous decision ever, and obviously this was signed into law and affect the budget by de Blasio, elected to defund them by $1 billion with a B dollars. That's
ridiculous.
1/6 of their budget. So now the cops are dealing with, a lot of folks are leaving the police force early. They're taking early retirements. And who wants to come on the job now and deal with what these cops have got to deal with? So yeah, you're going to see, there's going to be some dark old days returning before I think things turn around and people realize this ain't the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, just all that work, like you talked about, James, in years before under leadership like Giuliani, all gone in what, 3 months? I mean, it's just amazing. You mentioned it. I talk to cops all over the country all the time, and obviously they're frustrated. They've been kicked in the nuts. The morale is down. What would you, if somebody came to you and said, James, you know, I want to get into, you know, I want to be a New York City cop. I want to be a municipal cop, wherever. What advice would you give somebody at this point?
Man, it's hard because, you know, I've always felt
I struggle with this.
Yeah. I've always felt that paying it forward and being, I remember the name and the person and the place and time that took the time to sit down with me. His name was Eddie Peterson. He was a legend in the FBI in the Newark, New Jersey division of the FBI. This guy took some time, and it was, I don't know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever it was, to sit down with this kid, and I was a kid at the time, and talk to me about a career in the FBI. And I'll never forget that. And I always said to myself, I'm going to do what he did, but I'm going to do it on steroids. I'm going to pay this forward. So if someone reaches out to me on my website, if someone reaches out to me in email, if someone reaches out to me, I never say no to talking to some young person that wants to go into law enforcement or the military. But to your point, man, I'm struggling right now because I'm going, it is a different world. And the support that was just, it was part of the normal process. You know, you and I talked earlier about, you know, before we went live here, about qualified immunity. They are setting up roadblocks now to make who in their right mind would want to do a job where you have to make split second decisions. You've got to make a decision in a nanosecond, in low light situations, and then have somebody on a civilian complaint review board sit back and use stop action cameras and slow things down to 1/1,000th of what you had to deal with so that they can look at this and then grill you and tell you that your decisions in real time, in extremis, meaning at the point of death, your decisions were wrong. So it's tough. I'm not talking kids out of doing it, but I am preparing them and telling them it is a different world of policing than the one I joined, geez, almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I remember Rodney King, and so do you, James, you know, and it was a horrible incident, and there were ripple effects, you know, throughout law enforcement, but this is different, man. I mean, it's just a different vibe. It's just a different feeling. And I agree with you. It's going to reverberate for, I don't know. Maybe a couple election cycles. It's going to be there, and like I said, I struggle with this because my son was kicking around the idea. We have kids. You have kids. It was kicking around the idea of law enforcement, and I told him, look, you know, I don't want to dissuade him from doing something he didn't want to do or doesn't want to do, and he's still in the military. But he was like, talk about after. But it's like, I want to kind of, this is the reality of it. But then again, he could be, and many others could be a catalyst for change. You know, it's just so hard now.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things that's important for us to remember is, You know, our country's only 244 years old, mm-hmm. right? The planet's 4.5 billion years old, and civilization's been here a lot longer than the United States of America. But we've survived a lot. And
sure.
And you and I probably, you know, I was 3 years old in 1968. But we had horrific riots back then in
yeah.
Watts and in Newark and in Los Angeles and at the Democratic National Convention. Look, we've stood up against fascism and the Nazis. We've stood up against you. We won the Cold War. We've dealt with all kinds of incursions of communism, different things like that. We've dealt with the scourge of slavery, which unfortunately we participated in for sure. for a little bit longer than, you know, the rest of the modern world did. So we've got no excuse. We're still the greatest country in the world. We've shed more of our blood. We've spent more of our treasure to preserve freedom and to make sure that peoples that want to be, you know, self-governed have the opportunity to do that than any other country in the history of the world. Having
Absolutely.
Said that, as bad as things are now, they are now, I believe we'll survive this. I believe it's going to be tough. I think we're as divided now as we've probably ever been, but I believe that the union and that the Constitution is strong enough and formidable enough that we will survive this.
I love it. I love that optimism, brother. As long as you keep wearing your mask, James, we're gonna survive. now we talked about all the craziness going on in the city. So let's kind of shift gears a little bit, if you don't mind. And why? And again, I'm just a simpleton, but why is the government unable to squash groups like Antifa? I mean, everybody looks at the news and you see what's going on in Portland every night. What, 63 days now, or 64 days of just chaos? Brave men and women out there on the front lines. Why are they allowed to keep going? And again, maybe that's a stupid question I'll ask you.
Well, and again, I'm trying to look at this from the law enforcement perspective,
sure.
and not try to take it down political lanes. But I think that
there is a
political party that is made up of progressives that, you know, and many of them, the older or their senior ones that grew up during the 60s and 70s radicalization period, that are now in charge and now calling the shots, and they just can't stand up and say, this is wrong. When you shine a laser at a federal officer's eyes and burn their retina mm-hmm. so that they are permanently blinded, when you throw balloons filled with fecal matter, when you throw frozen water bottles, rocks, and bricks, when you burn police precincts, when you loot businesses, when you believe that anarchy is the answer to everything. And look, you know, we talked a few minutes ago about them pulling, you know, monuments and memorials down. Look, you can make the argument that, you know, pulling down monuments to the Confederacy or to Confederate generals is appropriate in 2020. That's not just who they're pulling monuments mm-hmm. down of. They're yeah. pulling monuments down of Washington.
Abolitionist.
Jefferson. Yeah, and to your point, of Frederick Douglass. I mean, these are people, these are spoiled. The vast majority of these black-clad Antifa crew, they are spoiled white kids with mm-hmm. no sense of history, that don't know, you know, John Brown from Robert E. Lee. They don't know, you know, Frederick Douglass from, you know, the Burt Society. It's just, they don't have any sense of history, perspective, context, or any of those things. And unfortunately, they vote.
Yeah.
So the smart people on both sides of political perspective that vote, dumb people that don't care to learn our history and don't care about anything other than their rigid ideological views, they vote also. And that's yeah. that, you know, it's what Winston Churchill famously said: the best argument against a democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter.
Yeah. And those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
And we were talking again before, James, I know you do a lot of keynotes on leadership and leadership development. And I really do think, this is a lack of leadership, obviously. I mean, this is why a lot of this is allowed to flourish, is just, and again, we've hit on it, just lack of leadership on so many different levels.
Yeah, I think leadership is important. And look, leadership comes in all stripes, colors, ethnicities, sexual orientations. Mm-hmm. It's not derivative of one political party versus another. Leadership is, it's something that, you know, you understand too, you know, having served in a, you know, in units of, you know, great military lineage and with some great historical leadership that led that unit. I always take everything back to this. People ask me all the time, well, what's the greatest leadership quote of all time? Because if you Google leadership quotes, I think your search engine will blow up and start smoking. It'll come back with like 3 gazillion with a G. But I'm going to make it easy for your listeners, okay? Dwight David Eisenhower, the 34th president of the United States, the five-star general, one of the last 2 five-star generals in our country's history, West Point class of 1915, just an unbelievable leader. He led the troops in the Normandy invasion. He was a supreme Allied commander, just a humble man, a decent man. I believe he gave the greatest leadership quote of all time. I'll give it to you, and then you can argue with me and tell me I'm wrong, but good luck. Bring some friends and pack a lunch. I am resolute on this one. So President Eisenhower, or General Eisenhower, said this: the art of leadership is getting someone else to do something you need done because he or she wants to do it. The art of leadership is the ability to have someone else do something you need done for the mission because they want to do it. And really, that's it, because absolutely. You know from being in the military and you know from being in law enforcement that, you know, hey, if a general tells a private to do something, he has to do it. You know, if a police chief tells a rookie cop to do something, he or she has to do it. But when you can convince somebody to do something because they want to do it and it supports the mission, you're a leader.
Yeah. And it's that trust, you know, like that they trust you. They trust you to make the right decisions. And it's respect, James. You know that. They respect you as a leader. I think a lot of people out there always said, and because I teach and do other stuff, I always said, you know, rank doesn't make you a leader. And there's a lot of people out there, because I come from a military and law enforcement background, and there's so many people out there that, you know, I promoted up through the ranks, retired as a commander. And every time I promoted up the ranks, James, I knew I had to regain that trust with the troops. I just didn't assume that, well, you know, shit, I'm a commander right now. You have to respect me. No, I have to earn that respect again. And that's just how I was brought up. That's how I was trained. But I think so many people out there, again, shifting back to all the chaos that seems to be going on in these cities, well, I'm the mayor, you know, people are going to respect me. And that doesn't work that way.
Yeah. You know, you salute the epaulets, right?
Yes, exactly. You respect the rank.
You salute the rank, right? But that doesn't mean that the person that you're saluting is deserved of respect. You earn respect by being selfless. You earn respect by, you just mentioned it, the T word, trust. You know, your folks have to trust you that you're, A, not just going to make the right decision under difficult situations, but it's that old saying, right? Mission first, soldiers always. And that means, hey, I got to do whatever it takes to accomplish a mission. I may lose some of my men and women while attempting that to accomplish that mission, but I've also got to take care of my people. And it's sort of a conundrum, right? It's sort of a conundrum. But if you can pull that off, accomplishing the mission and at the same time taking care of your folks, and taking care of them doesn't mean that you're not going to put them into harm's way. That's your job as a SWAT team leader. That's your job as a police chief. That's your job as a line, you know, infantry platoon, you know, second lieutenant. That's your job to do that. But you've got to prepare them. You've got to give them all the resources they need and deserve. You've got to give them the best opportunity to win. And if you do those things, they will crawl across broken glass on their hands and knees for you.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you about the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, which you're heavily involved in. But first, since you brought up the SWAT team, I got to ask you, man, I know you were part of the New York City's or New York FBI, New York office SWAT team, awarded the Medal of Bravery. You were part of the badass FBI elites HRT team. You got to tell me about those experiences, because being a law enforcement, you guys are like the cream of the crop, HRT, FBI. I mean, that's a badass unit, brother. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
No, I appreciate that. And I always say, you know, it's one of those things, you know, when you get medals for things, and, you know, a lot of people don't get medals for doing great things that either somebody didn't see, you know, how many deserved Medal of Honor winners in the U.S. military never got the Medal of Honor because no one was there to see what they did. Yeah. And then how many times do you get a medal and you go, I really didn't deserve that? I mean, I really look at it like that. I mean, medals are wonderful and they're nice recognition and the whole nine yards, but I served with plenty of folks that were a lot braver, a lot more
absolutely
brave, and did a lot bigger and more valorous things in front of me than I ever did in front of them. But yeah, as far as the FBI hostage rescue team, super proud to have been a part of that. There's only 52 men that serve on that. It's been around since 1983. It's the country's only civilian counterterrorism team. They jump out of planes, they fast rope, they use explosive breaching. They have all the tools of the trade that say Delta Force or SEAL Team 6 or, you know, the Army Rangers have. They have all those requisite tools of the trade, but they operate within the United States with some limited exceptions, which are mostly classified things overseas. But they are the counterterrorism contingent here in the United States, because you can't use the military to, you know, to implement or to enforce our laws. But probably it's almost like picking one of your favorite children, because they're all your favorite. But my 4 years on the FBI hostage rescue team, I mean, I was a young guy, I was fit. It was literally like we got the best clothing, the best equipment, the best training, the best travel, the best missions. And I say this all the time, it's the closest to being a professional athlete I could have ever dreamed of being, and probably the most fun of my 25-year career. Those 4 years are probably the most fun.
Well, you get to get some kick-ass training, blow stuff up. That's amazing. It was like when I was in the Army.
Exactly.
Well, again, brother, thank you for your service in that elite unit. Let's talk about, really quick, about the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and your involvement with that, sir.
Well, again, you know, I've been blessed in my lifetime, like Forrest Gump, to be associated with some amazing, amazing institutions, organizations, and agencies. But trust me, I am but a tiny cog in the machine that is the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. And if anybody is interested in donating to it, it is a worthwhile cause. What it does is, it is a police advocacy group, and it is a group that supports, that raises money to pay the legal expenses for, and this is important, we don't defend or help pay the financial, the defense financial obligations for any cop that's ever charged with something. We look at each case, we evaluate it, the board votes on it, and then a determination is made whether or not the board will take the case on. And I'll give you an example. You know, the case in Minneapolis, we all agree, it doesn't matter who you are. The cop there, Derek Chauvin, that has been, you know, charged with second degree murder. Look, he deserves his day in court. You know, he's an alleged murderer. He's not a murderer until a jury says that he is. But that's not a case that the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund would case take. The one in Atlanta where a man who was intoxicated was, you know, the police attempted to apprehend him, and Wendy's drive-through line, he fought them violently. He took one of their tasers and then fired it at them, and a police officer ended up having to use deadly force. We have taken that case, and we will help him in his financial obligations to defend himself as well as his family. So, you know, we use discernment to determine which cases, you know, we should take and which we shouldn't. But the goal of the organization is advocacy, education for folks that, you know, want to know more about, hey, what is it like to be a police officer when you're making split second decisions? And we do training seminars and put out literature. We advocate for cops. And then the biggest piece is, and we do this through generous donations from citizens across the world, not just across the country, but it is to help alleviate the financial burden of a wrongfully accused law enforcement officer who's fighting for his life, not just his career, but for his life. We do defend them in court.
So needed. And I wish there were more organizations that were doing that. And another thing really quick, you hit on, you know, the education, James, as you know, I think a lot of people out there get what they know from law enforcement off movies and television shows. And most people out there have no idea what law enforcement does on a daily basis, whether you're at the municipal, state, or federal level. They have no idea. They just get it from TV or movies. And the brave men and women out there need those defense funds like you are doing right now.
That's such an important point that you're making. It's the same thing when I remember teaching a class at St. John's a couple years ago, and there was a young man, a young African-American kid in my class, wickedly smart. The kid probably could have taught the course. He was really that much of a standout student. And I remember there was a police shooting that took place in Charlotte, and it was an African-American police officer that actually killed the man who had a gun in his car. But of course, there were people that were protesting and rioting, and of course CNN and a lot of the other news outlets were carrying it, you know, live streaming the details of it, you know, day in and day out. And I'll never forget having a conversation in class. It was a very small class, about 20 students or whatever, and we had a lot of engagement, interactive engagement. And he looked at me after I'd said something. He says, "Professor, how can you even say that, you know, that black men aren't unfairly targeted by police, and that they're not, you know, that they aren't hunted down and killed with reckless abandon? Don't you watch the news?" And I stopped for a second, and, you know, and first of all, my class is all about trying to get past all of our implicit biases,
sure,
but also the cognitive biases and what we call the availability heuristic. And I don't want to get too technical because everyone's going to sit there and their eyes are going to glaze over. But what it means is, the more you see something, the more you believe it to be true. So if you watch the news and the only types of incidents involving, you know, a fatal use of force by a police officer, and you're hearing about it involving a black man, you're going to become conditioned to believe that that's the way it is. So for your listeners, and I'll say this really quickly here, for your listeners, unfortunately, for too long, we've not had any reliable mechanism or means to collect the data. Fatal use of force incidents. Now, the Washington Post began doing this in 2015. You can Google it, Washington Post police use of force database, and you can see the numbers. And let me just give you the numbers, you know, writ large here. Every year in this country, every year, police officers have 250 million, with an M, interactions with citizens. Some of them are as benign as, "Hey, I need you to pull a little tighter to the curb," or,
sure,
"Hey, are you lost?"
Just contacts. Yeah.
Yeah. Just that's it. That is just interactions. That's not, you know, deadly force interaction. 250 million. Of those 250 million, 1,000 of them, 1,000 result in deadly use of force by police. The vast majority of those are of armed subjects who are trying to kill a police officer or kill innocents. A handful of those, when I say a handful, 50 or 60 maybe, dealing with people that are unarmed. Now, when someone hears that, they say, "Well, police should never shoot somebody unarmed." Well, when you go to arrest somebody and they're unarmed, in quotation marks, and they violently resist and they try to take your gun, or they pick up a stick on the side of the road and hit you in the head, they are considered unarmed. Mm-hmm. So it's not accurate to say that those are people that were just peaceably surrendering. The last thing on this is this. Since 2015, the past 6 years, okay, there have been only 1 year where more unarmed, and I use that in quotation marks, black men were killed than white men. Usually it's the other way around. Now, people will argue and say, "But Jimmy, you're missing the point. If in a country of 327 million, white folks make up 66% and black folks make up 13%, that is a disproportionate representation." Well, you're accurate. But then you also have to look at patterns of offending, because groups don't offend the same way. And I know it's an uncomfortable topic, but you're going to have more interactions with groups, like, let's say, in the instance of African-Americans, or more specifically, the 6% of our population that are African-American men, you're going to have a disproportionate representation because they commit 54.9% of the homicides in the country and 50% of all crime. So, look, it's an uncomfortable conversation, but you've got to deal in facts.
Well, and it is. And thank you, James, for stating that, because I agree with you 100%. You mentioned the shooting in Atlanta really quick. Here's the thing that I just grapple with this, like probably a lot of people, whether you're black, white, orange, if a cop tells you to do something, just do it. Just do it. You know, and this kid in that was getting hooked up for DUI in Atlanta, that he was fine with it. You know, he was compliant until the cuffs went on and, you know, shit hits the fan. He would be alive today if he would have just done what the officers told him to do. That is not the place to fight a battle. I mean, I just don't get it. And it seems like there's just a culture out there where a cop tells me to do something, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to fight. And you know what? I always tell students, you are going to lose that fight. And I'm not saying that to sound like cocky and arrogant. You're going to lose that fight. So I don't get it. You know, I just don't get it. That's not the time and the place to argue. And he'd still be alive if he would have just got into custody without a fight.
I agree with you 100%. I had the same conversation, not just with my students, but also with some of the young men that I coached and mentored in the city of Newburgh, New York for many, many years, and said the exact same thing. Look, if something's done wrong, let's win that in court.
Exactly.
Let's not try to decide it on the street, because again, to your point, that cop has to go home to his family that night. That cop is going to go home to their family that night. So when you put undue stress on the situation, when you take a peaceable situation and you ratchet it up and you escalate it, you can train somebody all day, a police officer at the academy in de-escalation training. But if you refuse to be handcuffed, if you refuse to be apprehended, when that police officer's job, his sworn duty, is to bring you to meet justice in a court of law, what do you want us to do? Defund the police and abolish the police people? Call a social worker? Call a violence interrupter or disruptor? Call a social science intermediary? I mean, seriously, what do you want us to do with people that are violent? I mean, you've got to have people that are ready to put their hands on somebody and bring them to justice.
Yeah. And in this day and age, James, you mentioned stats. It just seems like we just have this follow the lemming mentality off the cliff. We live in the greatest time as far as information goes. I'm not saying everything you research online is you know, the truth. I'm just saying, educate yourself, people. Look at the stats like James just said. He's not making them up. If you don't believe what he's saying, research yourself. These are the stats. Stats don't lie. Numbers don't lie. And it just amazes me how many people, and I got relatives like this, that person said it, so it must be true, so I'll just go along with him. And it's just ridiculous. Educate yourself.
Yeah, I love your descriptor there of lemmings, because, you know, I use that term all the time with my students. You know, don't follow the crowd. Don't be a lemming. I mean, go and educate yourself. If you've got a question about something, you know, go educate. Understand also what are righteous places where you can go get information. Yeah. Understand the leanings of, you know, whether it's a cable news network or whether or not it's a periodical or a written outlet. Understand the angles that people have. Educate yourself. If you don't do that, then you do become a lemming.
Yeah. James Galliano, I could talk with you all day, sir. If people want to reach out to you, how can they find you?
Best way to do that is I have a website. It's James A. Galliano, my last name, which is GAGLIANO.com. There's plenty of opportunities there. You can book me if you want me for something like that. Or if you've got a question or you want to be, you know, I have students that reach out to me at times and just want some advice or for me to point them in the right direction. I answer every reach out. So that's the best way to get in touch with me.
James, thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to come on the show, your honorable service to this great country, and of course, your honorable Leo service, sir. Much success to you in the future. I'd love to have you back on down the road.
Well, if I don't get asked back, I'm going to know I said something right. So I hope to get an invite.
All right, James. Take care, brother.
You got it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.